This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series and it is World Rare Disease Day tomorrow. Coincidentally, it's falling on the 29th of February. Very rare.
Once every four years.
And we're going to have a lot of those conversations today because it's given a lot of very little coverage, but I think this time, this year, we've decided to do a lot more with, I think you would have heard PSAs on BFM on rare disease. We've spoken to some patients, we've spoken to family members and, you know, even from people from the society to bring about more awareness. So we have in the studio with us Professor Dr. Tong Miao Kyong. He's a consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist, and he's going to help us understand rare diseases even more. Sorry, George, I didn't say hello to you.
No, it's okay. I completely forgot about you. It's all right. I'm part of the furniture, so you can easily forget about me. That's right.
It's one of those rare occasions that I've forgotten all about
because
you.
Because I was waving like that and then didn't even get any attention.
I know.
But it's okay. I have to get used to this.
I know you do. So this year's theme is equity for people living with a rare disease, and it is the theme for World Rare Disease Day. What does this mean, Dr. Tong? What does that actually tell you?
Okay, first of all, thanks for having me here today. And one of the reasons why we are focusing on going to the media rather than have big public events for some of the COVID-19, and so that's why we're here and they try to generate a lot of airwaves for our patients. Now, the reason why the equity is an important word here is to differentiate it from the word equitable. Now, equity simply means that, you know, irrespective of what you have, you should be given the same amount of attention and care just like anyone else. Perhaps maybe you cost a bit more to treat that patient. But nevertheless, because you are important and every patient is important to us, so equity is the word that we use as opposed to equitable.
Okay, and hence you felt the urgency to make sure that the word equity was there for everybody to understand.
That's right.
You know, there's no universal definition for a rare disease. Can you tell us how you define a rare disease, really?
That's the first questions that I get asked quite often. The reason why it's not easy to define a rare condition is because unlike COVID-19, where you know there's a, you know, there's a virus, there's a disease, and you know the year, rare diseases like affects millions of people. There are 6,000 different types at least of them, and each one probably they're like 1 in 10,000. So it's very hard to give a definition for what is constitute a rare disease. So what we have said usually in the past and till today is that a rare disease or a rare disorder is a condition that affects a small number of people in the population. And in many countries, for example, in the Euro, for example, they had defined as, you know, 1 in 2,000. In America, it's like 250,000 people affected by the condition.
One in 250,000?
250,000 patients in the whole country in the US. They use a slightly different way. So in Malaysia, for example, we were grappling with that number for a long time. And of course, the Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, having thought about hard and long about this and adopted a very empirical figure, 1 in 4,000. So that's how it is. But we are still waiting for some kind of official definition. And I must say that the Ministry of Health has taken the first steps recently to try to arrive at this number. And I believe there were some meetings in 2019 under the previous government.
Mira, it's interesting. Dr. Tong highlighted that, you know, although it's 1 in 4,000, 1 in 5,000, or whatever number that is, cumulatively, that accounts to many, many diseases and many, many sufferers. And therefore, that equity or equal opportunities in order to get treatment and the voice is crucially important.
Okay. Precisely.
So, George, 32 million divided by 4,000, how much is that? Come on, you went to Chinese school.
All right. correct. Okay, moving along swiftly.
400. Is that 800,000?
That's for one disease. In 4,000 for one disease.
Oh, I
and
see.
And cumulatively, so, different diseases.
Correct. And there are 6,000 diseases. So there are some calculations we made on this, and some of these conservative numbers range from 3 to 5% of the population. And if you think, if you take the 3% of the, you know, 32 million, well, that's close to a million
people
in Malaysia alone with rare disorders.
Well, which, that's a lot of people.
A lot, yeah.
I mean, in fact, earlier on, we heard some statistics to say, like, in the US alone, it can be up to several millions of the population who actually suffer from the disease.
Exactly. They use a very conservative number, and still it goes into millions of people.
So why is it rare?
Well, because each individual condition is rare.
It's small in number.
So one of my favorite tagline is individually rare, but collectively common.
Wow.
That is absolutely correct.
You should use that for next 4 years, because you have to wait another 4 years to get another, rare disease day, right?
No, la, you don't. They pick it. It's the last day of February, I think, every month.
Well, they take the last day of February.
Yes, every year. It just happens this year, the 29th. It's usually the 28th of February.
Yeah.
What are the problems of the lack of this proper definition? And if it is indeed rare, can we just use a number worldwide? Is there anything wrong with
That's a very good question, Mira, because we've been grappling with this too. Without a definition, it's very hard to get statistics, right? And in Malaysia, statistics are very hard to come by, especially accurate ones. And people are trying to set up registries for various diseases. So we have a registry for cancer and so on. But unlike cancer, which has a lot of spotlight and a lot of supporters, unfortunately, rare diseases basically did not have that kind of awareness, did not have that much support from the population, for example. So we are still trying to get that level of attention so that more people are aware of it, so that we can actually generate enough attention and focus on this situation.
On that basis, is it fair to say that the vast majority of these are genetic-related conditions and then therefore they come under your remit? And on top of that, parents tend to take up advocacy roles in highlighting this.
Yeah. So 80% of our patients with rare diseases, rare disorders have a genetic basis for it. And yes, you're absolutely right. Because of lack of attention from, policy makers and many other agencies, parents themselves have taken this issue into their own hands. And many of them are stepping forward and they're doing it for their children, because often they will hear this common refrain that says that if I don't do it, there's nobody else is going to do it for my child.
Yes.
So I'm going to do it. And one of the things they always, that quote Robert Frost in his famous poem, many miles before I go to sleep, I have promises to keep. Do you remember that poem?
Yes.
The forest is lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go.
You can tell George and I are pretending. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I love his ear.
Yes.
Because if he did, he would have jumped out of his chair by now.
Mira sends a rat straight away. It's like, start pretending to be a cultured. Right? Okay, I'm not being pretending to be cultured here. I want to ask you a typical journey. Let's say, can you give the listeners the benefit of a typical disease that was diagnosed and sort of journey that the parents encounter before coming to you and subsequently taking on that role of caring for the child?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many of these conditions. They have the brittle bone disease, or what we call osteogenesis imperfecta.
Mm-hmm.
We have the muscular ones like Duchenne muscular dystrophy and spinal muscular atrophy.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these genetic metabolic disorders and so on. Now, typically, they have this situation where we call them the diagnostic odyssey. Now, as a medical person, you would know, sometimes when they go and see a doctor, they may not get the answer, they may not get the test, and then they wander off to another doctor or another general practitioner or specialist trying to get an answer to what their child is having. And very often, this takes years. there are some patients I have who took 17 years before they got the correct diagnosis for what they have.
And that would be Muha Aziz, who,
yes,
who has ganglia glioma. I mean, we've spoken to Muha even before. And 17 years only to find out that he had that condition.
So this is unacceptable in my mind that, you know, you have to have this diagnostic odyssey of such immense length of time before they actually get a diagnosis. What more treatment that that they need so much in the early part of the disease?
And we're quoting the ones who eventually got the diagnosis. Yeah. The vast majority of them are probably just living in a community without a proper diagnosis or attention.
That's right.
How many of us, do all of us have a risk of having a rare disease, Dr. Tong?
Well, looking at, you know, statistics, if you say 80% genetics, then all of us are at risk. There's no sparing of anyone that tell you that you're not going to get a rare disease. Many people had this thinking that, oh, it only affects babies and kids and so on. It's not true. You have seen people with multiple sclerosis, and you have this ice bucket challenge where there's a condition called lateral sclerosis, right? And many other conditions even today that affects a small minority of patients with certain rare cancers, for example. And many of these conditions, it happens to anyone, regardless of gender, your socioeconomic background, your racial groups. I wish sometimes politicians can see that, you know, when we work in the front line for patients with rare diseases, it doesn't matter who you are, the suffering and the pain is the same.
Okay. On a genetic level, can you explain this to us? Because if it is genetic, what you're saying is it's being passed down from generation to generation.
That's
but
right.
You may not have generations before you who have had a rare disease.
Okay.
So how then would I know that I'm actually carrying a gene that
is
defective and it's going to play out in the form of a rare disease?
This sounds like an exam, right?
Yeah, this sounds like a lecture.
No, I want to understand what's happening on a genetic level.
Genetics 101.
Because then if it is indeed what we understand of, you know, genetic, it would mean we would know of somebody else in the family who may have that rare condition.
Yeah.
And then it's easier to diagnose. You can have family history, I have. But that's not the case with rare diseases.
Yeah. So for those listeners who understand a little bit about genetics, they are different types of inheritance. So what Mira was talking about was those with a direct effect from one generation to another. There's a term we call dominant effect. So you would see in one of the parents, and you might have a 50-50 chance of passing on to the children at every pregnancy. So that's one of those inheritance. But there are many other forms of inheritance where both parents are carriers, but carriers are healthy people in that situation. But when two carriers marry each other, they might have a 25% risk of having a genetic disease in each pregnancy. Now, when that happens, when you look back at the family tree, there's nobody else with that condition. One of the common diseases that we have in Malaysia is thalassemia, for example. Both parents could be silent carriers. They're perfectly healthy and well, no issues at all, but they would have a 25% chance or 1 in 4 chance in each pregnancy that they may have a child with severe thalassemia major.
Yeah, Prof Tong, presumably there are always another scenario where genetically there is a kind of a sporadic or spontaneous mutation, or presumably like musculosclerosis, that it's multifactorial that eventually get the disease manifested. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, of course, genetics can also happen spontaneously, but we call it de novo change. That means there's nobody else in the family and the child could be the first one in the family to have that. Yes, that could have happened too.
And you don't know why that could possibly happen?
Well, it could be luck of the draw, chance, yep. Or sometimes we find out much later that it could be some environmental factors.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not just a straightforward kind of like one parent carrying certain genes and then it's passed to the next generation.
And very often now we find that it's what we call multifactorial genetic condition, meaning that you have a certain set of genes, but unless it's got triggered off by environment, you might not get a condition. For example, the favorite example I use is neural tube defects or spinal bifida. Mm-hmm. If a mom does not take enough folic acid before she conceive, usually we recommend 400 microgram daily 1 month mm-hmm. before conception. There's a chance that she might have this condition called neural tube defects or spinal bifida, mm-hmm. which is quite a rare condition too in our community.
Okay, I'm just thinking of, you know, what you said about a couple getting together, both being carriers, and then you don't know you're a carrier. So now how do we panic when we get married or when we would have children? Or do we screen? Do we check? What do we do? With thalassemia, there's been a lot of awareness, right? Because, and that's not a rare disease, am I correct? Thalassemia is not considered a rare disease?
Depending on the community you talk to, in Western population, it's considered a rare disease because they're like one in 10,000. But in Asian country, it's so common. So sometimes if you use a one definition of one in 2,000, they don't even fit because they are much more common than that. For example, among the Kadazan Dusun community in Sabah, it's very common.
Oh, how so interesting.
They don't even fall into that category anymore.
Okay. And that's got to do with perhaps race, you know. Okay, so for an example, if it is, say, the Indian community, for an example, it probably goes back to our people back in India and stuff, and we carry it in that you know, based on race. Am I correct? So
yeah.
is that to say, well, Asians, for an example, carry it more?
It just happens that we live in the area, and of course, thalassemia has its relationship with malaria. Have you heard about that connection?
No.
Carriers, for example, it's like Darwin, right? Survival of the fittest. So basically, if you carry a certain gene variant, for example, it confers you certain advantage in survival. So in this instance, if you happen to be a thalassemic carrier, you're perfectly well. But in addition to that, you also had protection from severe malaria infection, mm-hmm. which means that if you are a carrier, you survive. And you survive to marry and have children, mm-hmm. right? And then you pass it on to your offspring. And therefore, the entire population, sooner or later, will be carriers to a large numbers. Mm. But one of the price you pay for that advantage is that you will have a 25% chance of having that thalassemic condition if both carriers happen to marry.
Mm-hmm. So you have antibodies towards malaria? Is that what you're saying?
No, they had this. The red blood cells of these thalassemic patients are much more resistant to malaria parasites.
Which is probably something that, because of evolution, they have built up.
Yeah, so because you carry that particular thalassemic gene, right, you are much more resistant to malaria. But
okay.
There is a double-edged sword. Yeah. You get the advantage of that.
Of protection from malaria. From
them, but subsequently, if you
so there's no free lunch, really.
happen to marry a carrier, then you have a 25% chance.
And malaria is very much in this part of the world.
And that's why you call it a malaria belt. So we have a lot of genetic diseases that are related to malaria, like thalassemia, G6PD deficiency.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, you didn't answer my question about whether or not now if we decide to get married and have children, okay. Whether we should get ourselves screened. We'll come back and find out more up next. It's World Rare Disease Day tomorrow. We're going to come back and find out more about, you know, screening for genes, the diagnosis. Why is it takes so long to actually diagnose? For Muha Aziz, for an example, it took 17 years. Funding, for an example, medications are very expensive to treat rare diseases. In some cases, government don't even bring it in. And at the same time, if you want to purchase it from abroad, you can't. So what are your options? If you have a question for us, number to call is...
Yeah, it's 7732900, or you can WhatsApp us of 01878898899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, because it's a Friday, we only let him come on a Friday. And Professor Dr. Tom Miao Kyung, he's a consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist. We are discussing World Rare Disease Day 2020, which is falling tomorrow. It's usually the last day of February, and coincidentally, it's a leap year, so tomorrow is technically the last day. So,
what happened to the last 2 months? Really, that's like we're moving. It's like we thought the Christmas just came along.
Yes.
Just not too long ago.
It's March already on Sunday.
Exactly.
And so much has happened.
Yes.
We've seen so much happening.
COVID, and then 19, and then we had the Australian fire, and the market's gone a bit haywire at the moment. Never mind. We'll talk about rare diseases.
And our political influx, whatever you want to call it.
It's okay. Just drink a cup of tea. We'll be fine.
Yeah, but you know, that's going to affect rare diseases. We'll come back and talk about that, the political kerfuffle that we're in and how that will impact access and you know, developments in this area. But let's talk about that, what we spoke about, two partners getting married and having children. Yep. Should we be concerned? For thalassemia, you can check whether you're a carrier or not.
Yep.
In this case, what do we do?
Yep. We'll continue on our genetics 101 now. Mm-hmm. So basically, all of us carry 25,000 pairs of genes, mm-hmm. right? Half of that, that means 25,000 from dad and 25,000 from mum. And that's how we add up 25,000 pairs of genes. Now, each of these genes is akin to a recipe, right? Where there are very strict instructions written or encoded. And if you are a chef or a cook, if you misread one of the ingredients, you might not have the proper cake or the proper dish that you wanted to cook. So basically, the genes function like that. There's a gene to make your hair, one to make your bones, and so on and so forth. So if you have a typo or an error in the gene or a spelling mistake in one of them, we call that a variant or a mutation. And that would lead to a malfunctioning of that particular gene, leading to a specific disease. Mm. Now, all of us carry about 6.4 billion alphabets. 6.4 billion alphabets in every cell. Mm-hmm. The error rate is very, very, very low. It's about 0.1%. But even so, with 0.1% error rate, you still get about 6 million changes in every cell that we have. Oh. Fortunately, majority of them are benign. Mm-hmm. Perhaps maybe up to 5 to 10 of them are truly what we label in the medical world as pathogenic or disease-causing. Mm. All right. So all of us are mutants.
Yes.
None of us are perfect. And because of that factor, as you marry someone, there will always be a risk for a genetic condition to manifest itself, provided if you have happened incidentally, coincidentally marry another person who is carrying the same faulty gene as you, one of 10, for example. Mm-hmm.
0.1% in general.
Yeah.
That
error rate.
That would be an error rate. Yeah. Doesn't mean it's going to be pathogenic, as you said.
Yeah.
How much of the population is open to the 0.1% error?
All of us carry that 0.1% error rate.
It's already inherent.
Yeah. It's standard based.
So hence we're mutant.
Right.
Not perfect.
We are mutants.
Even mirror.
And that's the same reason why we can evolve and adapt to our environment, because obviously some of these changes that we have might confer survivability factor. So if you have that special gene, for example, that is resistant to HIV, you might not even get infected.
Okay.
And that's how it happens.
So how Mira highlighted that if both parents, both sets of parents actually know in advance where are their...
How would you find out? Well, would you even... So how much of that 0.1% is that ends up pathogenic?
So as I said, perhaps up to 5 to 10... 10 out of that 6 million will be pathogenic. Mm-hmm. But it may be more, depending on the population that we're talking about.
I mean, Mira and I on air had done genetic testing before. We were conned to actually scrape some tissues from our buccal mucosa and then sent for analysis. Actually, I never checked my results. I was too scared to check my results.
Neither did I.
So if I were to marry Mira, right? Okay, just hypothetically. If we actually know these two sets of genetic data, would it make any difference that we want to make sure that our kid will never endure or have any problems with rare disease?
Okay, good question.
First, how would we find out?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You guys have a buccal swab and presumably you had some genetic test results.
Don't listen to this buccal swab.
No,
just swabbing the inner part of your cheek, that's all.
That's buccal swab.
Okay, that's a buccal swab.
We don't know what that is.
We didn't know. Well, actually, I knew what it was, but we sent it out, but just too scared to find out the results.
Okay.
Buccal swab.
So, yeah, hypothetically, you can come back with two sets of reports, and the reports will tell us what sort of variation in the genomes that you have. And then we would, the genetic counselors and the clinical geneticists would have a look at the long list, and then we'll say, okay, it's good news because neither of you had pathogenic mutation in the same gene. You may have, George may have his own 10 pathogenic mutations, Mira might have her own sets of 10 mutations which are pathogenic, but because you guys do not have the same sets of genes that having the same mutation, therefore the risk is not present for those conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, spontaneous mutation does occur, and genetic testing is still not perfect. The technology is perfect. It's very, very accurate, but there are parts of the genome, for example, mm-hmm. that they can't sequence. So there are still blind spots, so to speak.
Okay. Do parents do that, especially if they have a child who already diagnosed with rare disease, and then obviously ensuring the second child doesn't have the same problem?
That's quite a standard practice now in our setting, because if you have a child with a genetic condition, a rare condition, we would then proceed to do genetic tests or genomic tests, nowadays we call it. And if the child indeed has the condition, we would then work it backwards and test the parents as well to see whether they're carriers. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that we do, and we counsel them before they do the genetic test, which is very essential because we have to prepare them for the possibilities that they are carriers, which they are not aware of. So we have to preempt any emotional, psychosocial issues, blame issues, and guilt issues that may arise. Mm-hmm. So giving them options, say, if you do not wish to know what you have, it's perfectly all right not to go for the test. That's their right.
But based on what you've said, there are still blind spots, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you know the changes in the genes, and for those couples who wish to have a second child, so they can use that information now to do prenatal diagnosis. And technology is so advanced now, you can even do non-invasive prenatal tests, whereby once the mom is pregnant, we can take a few drops of her blood, maybe a couple of mils of her blood, and extract fetal DNA circulating in mom's blood.
Not even amniocentesis and that sort of
non-invasive.
Yeah, it's non-invasive. So technology has now enabled that we can even extract fetal DNA, minute amount, the smallest amount, and amplify that from the maternal circulation. So without doing any invasive tests, and they can actually make a diagnosis for some of these rare conditions.
Extraordinary.
And how accurate is that?
They're pretty accurate technology, but it is not comprehensive. So they would set a number of conditions that they would test for. Mm-hmm. But theoretically, you can test for any genetic disease using that approach.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of rare diseases to check for.
Yeah. And that's where they have this another new type of technology called genomic sequencing. So it is already available in the market, where you can take the same buccal swab that you had and apply what you call next generation sequencing, and they will check every alphabet in the genome, the 6.4 billion alphabets. And that was what we call the Human Genome Project 20 years ago. And now they can do it for under $1,000.
Mm. Would you do it, George?
We already done it.
No, we didn't.
We had our swab taken. That's right, on air.
Somewhere. Waiting to be used against
us. That's right, exactly.
But really, I wouldn't do it, would you?
Well, actually, for parents who obviously had a first child like that, it must be an emotional dilemma. Because especially if you do a fetal blood test, and then when the fetal blood test comes up with another possibility of genetic defect, it must be heartbreaking to make a decision.
Absolutely. That's why, we often put in this requirement that if you were to go for any form of genetic testing, genetic counseling has to be done before you do any genetic testing. It is considered as unethical and certainly not professional to do any kind of genetic testing if you do not have any prior genetic counseling, pre and post.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mira, did you get any genetic counseling?
I didn't even go to do a test, George. Why would I need to be counseled?
No, if you're doubtful, you go back to the podcast and you realize that we actually did the test.
I know we did.
Right.
I don't know where the results are. That's what I'm more concerned about. We have a question here. Why does fibromyalgia not considered a rare disease? Does a parent, for example, a mum with a rhesus negative, contribute to this?
Yeah, there are two different conditions, as far as I know, fibromyalgia and rhesus. So I don't think there is a link that I'm aware of at the moment. What do you think, George?
No.
I mean, George, don't ask him anything.
Below the belt, yes.
Yes,
maybe.
Exactly.
Sorry, maybe I'll say. Prof Tong, I'm going to highlight two challenges.
Wait, I have a question here to ask from Nini, who says, my cousin's wife delivered a pair of twins, a boy and a girl, and the baby boy was diagnosed with G6PD enzyme deficiency, and the doctor said it's from his wife's gene. I'd like to know more about it. I'd like to know more about G6PD enzymes, the risks, and, you know, etc. Is G6PD a rare disease?
G6PD actually stands for glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. So, okay, it's an enzyme. So enzymes are made following genetic codes in our body. So basically, you're right, G6PD deficiency is a genetic condition. It's very common in this part of the world because it's related to the survivability with malaria. So they have done a lot of studies where they found in Malaysia, for example, up to 3 to 5% of males have G6PD deficiency. Now, he's absolutely right. It usually affects the boys and the males. The reason is because the gene for G6PD is carried on the X chromosome. Now, remember, the boys have an X and a Y. So the boys survive on one X chromosome. The females, on the other hand, have two X chromosomes. So even though the mum has one of the X chromosomes being affected, she has the other X chromosome, and therefore she has either non-existent disease or she may have a very mild form of G6PD deficiency. But for the boy, because he's only got one X chromosome and he's deficient in that particular gene, therefore, he would have this condition called G6PD deficiency.
Okay, so more boys suffer. Get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what we call an X-link recessive condition.
Yes. Yeah. Boys always suffer. That's right.
I'm sure. Yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll come back and find out more about rare diseases right after the market update. I'll let you ask your question after this, George. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. In the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Professor Dr. Tong Miao Kyung. He's a consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist. We are discussing World Rare Disease Day, which falls tomorrow, the 29th of February, trying to bring about more awareness on what a rare disease really is. So we've gone through the whole genetics thing and, you know, how that really happens. George, you had a question just
now. Yeah, I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, we interviewed a parent who actually was an advocate for
Edmund
the child.
Lim.
That's right, yeah.
Yep.
And he highlighted one thing, that a lot of these rare diseases actually do not have a standard FDA-approved treatment. Because he highlighted something like 90% of them. And therefore, a lot of the treatments are experimental, in air quotes. And as a result of that, it's difficult to get attention. Most of the time, they are quite expensive. So is that true? And how do you overcome such challenges?
Yeah, this is one of those hot topics now. We typically call them orphan drugs, like orphanages. The reason being is that drugs and pharmaceuticals cost a lot to be developed in the market before they get approved by FDA. So based on some of these issues surrounding rare diseases, the FDA has actually, on compassionate grounds, I believe, have loosened some of these requirements for these drugs for rare diseases and given them a designation. They call it the Orphan Drug Act in the US, whereby they will expedite the approval rates for these pharmaceutical drugs that are used in rare conditions with the hope that the patients would get treatment faster. And the manufacturers or the companies that make these drugs would have some incentives to develop these products, because obviously it would not be cost effective if they were to be made along the usual pathways. So often drugs are basically drugs that are used for rare diseases, and there are many countries which have legislation to allow the passages of orphan drugs into the country, for example.
So if I just define an orphan drug, it's just medications used for rare diseases or disorders. And on top of that, it's because they have a limited market. That's why they called orphan drugs. Yeah. And hence, you know, you said the incentives. I mean, what is the incentive to produce a drug for such a small population?
And also the difficulties doing trials on such small numbers.
Yeah. And then you have, when you break it down to different rare diseases, it's even smaller, right? As you said, 1 million in Malaysia, for an example, is broken down into so many different types of rare diseases, which is much smaller. So what about the cost, Dr. Tong? As a result, I can imagine how expensive it is.
Yeah.
But if you are able to afford it, I understand some of it comes into Malaysia, some of it doesn't. And if I can afford it, why can't I bring it in myself?
Yep. Now, there are many types of drugs for rare diseases. Some of them are not very expensive. For example, the treatment for brittle bone disease is a drug called bisphosphonates, which we also use to treat people with osteoporosis. Yes. But the form that we use in liquid form, injection form, and it's slightly more expensive. So for the B40 population, for example, it may be a bit of a stretch to make ends meet. So a little bit of support for that would be very helpful and goes a long way.
Do we have that?
Oh, yeah, definitely we have bisphosphonates.
The support for B40 groups?
Yes, we do. In fact, for many of these rare diseases, the government does give a lot of help. For example, some of these drugs that we use, and also for transplantation, for example, if you had a rare genetic condition that where you can be treated by stem cell transplantation, for example, bone marrow or umbilical stem cell, the government do offer some help within this Ministry of Health. Mm-hmm. But I'm coming back to some of these ultra-rare diseases, and you mentioned spinal muscular atrophy, where it occurs 1 in 10,000 people.
Yes.
We are fortunate in the sense that we are witnessing many new drug development. Unfortunately, as mentioned before, due to its rarity and difficulties in running trials and getting the patients, the cost of making those products are extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, SMA, the spinal muscular atrophy, that one of these drugs is reportedly one of the most expensive drug in the world, costing $2.1 million to treat one patient.
A year.
Just one time. It's a gene therapy.
Oh, boy. And that will cure it?
Yeah. I mean, if it's successful, it's been reported to even almost cure the condition.
Wow.
But that's so cruel, right?
But it gives so much hope as well. But where do you get the money from?
Precisely. So in many countries, it is well known that people have tried all sorts of ways, crowdfunding, compassionate use of drug donation, all sorts of creative way of health economics. But none of them can really help this patient with rare or ultra-rare conditions where it goes into R1 million a year, for example, for the rest of the child's life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in many, many countries like Australia, Taiwan, even Japan, South Korea, they have legislation that you should call Rare Disease and Orphan Drug Act, whereby that decision to allocate a certain amount of money or funding for this group of patients is given every year. And of course, it's answerable to Parliament in those countries about this allocation.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the ways that we are thinking that we should have in this country, provided whichever government that's take over.
Yeah, and it's sad because before this political influx or kerfuffle that we're in, the Pakatan Harapan's GE14 manifesto promised that it would increase the budget allocation and it would provide incentives for the participation of private companies and charitable bodies to actually tackle rare diseases. So we were getting, we were moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Baby steps, but we were moving.
Yeah. To be fair, I think previous governments, two, three governments, have been quite receptive. In fact, we started one of these treatment for lysosomal storage disease, like Pompe's and so on, way back in 2007, with an allocation of almost R8 million at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Pakatan Harapan government took over, they also had promised to increase it, and they did.
Yes.
So I think, to be fair, I think Both governments, previous governments, have been very receptive and helpful. But the thing is, the number of patients that we have are increasing, and the amount of money that is allocated is usually insufficient to cater for these large groups of patients who are now needing treatment. And due to the weak currency as well, the cost of it has multiplied.
Of course, yeah.
Mm. Okay, but we were... Okay, so given that we politics in flux, how do we then, what are we back to ground zero with going back to no avenues, or are there other avenues?
Well, I'm always an eternal optimist. you know, we have to in this line of rare
conditions. I'm happy you are.
we have to keep that up because I think we have made progress. Many of our patients with rare disease are getting treatment. Very often when we talk about treatment for rare disease, we think about the expensive drugs. But actually, we have moved along many fronts. For example, in terms of counseling, in terms of laboratory support, in terms of getting funds for patients who cannot afford speech therapy or rehabilitation services. But the other things that we still need to is to make sure that nobody gets left out, because, you know, the current situation is some patients do get treatment, but there's still quite a number are not getting the help they are needing. They're needing. So we have to be more what we call holistic in our approach, and be inclusive. The key word here is to be inclusive, so that no one gets left behind.
Because the society naturally will just say this is a rare disease, but there are a lot more other more common disease that deserves attention. So how do you continue to give rare disease a voice?
So this is where we said equity is for every patient with rare diseases, because you never know who or whether your family members will get this condition now or in the future. It's just like disability issues, right? You'll never know when you need a wheelchair. So you must always prepare for that day when... So you got to have ramps, you got to have all the services for people who are disabled, because you never know when you need it. Yes. It can happen to anyone.
Okay. Yeah. Mira, I have another question. You know, like when we interview Edmund, you know, at that time, the world is getting smaller. Information to become accessible to parents. When parents face with that sort of like a dilemma and difficulties, they always search all over the world and they come across all sorts of things. Some of them are bogus, some of them are real, and then a lot of them cost a lot of money. A lot of them cost a lot of barriers for them to be instilled or to apply to their kids. How do you stop them from being abused or, you know, being taken advantage of?
Yeah, this is where we strongly support, you know, support groups whereby they are accredited to, say, some kind of recognized institutions. And usually, if you want to get information that's up to date and accurate, the academic institutions' websites are usually much more accurate. Some NGOs, for example, do try to provide accurate information. And if you are always, if you're uncertain about that, you should always ask your medical practitioners to try to verify some of this information. I know that this is not a popular thing for busy doctors where a patient walk in with a pile of printouts from online.
And they will, right? I mean, they do. They come to see you, and they do that.
It's, right? It's inevitable, right? So I always teach medical students and say, look, you've got to be prepared because the patient may be more informed than you at some stage.
Yeah.
And especially with rare diseases.
That's right.
Because diagnosis takes such a long time as well. Do we know why?
Yeah. Part of the reason is because they were sort of told that they're not going to find a diagnosis. So very often, they might have one or two tests and it came back negative. And that's when parents stop looking for a diagnosis and they will focus on, say, more help in terms of rehabilitation, schooling, and so on. And part of the reason, because some of these tests are so expensive, just like its treatment. And that's because it's not affordable. So most parents gave up after a few tries.
Yeah. Or on the other hand, you have somebody like Edmund who would just keep charging ahead to find out answers on his own.
He's one of those few rare
parents. Yeah, he quit his job, and then both sets of parents would just carry on. and then, you know, facing those obstacles, and then hats off to him.
Not many parents could do that. So, you know, hats off to them for being such heroes to their children.
What about screening programs for newborns? Is that possible?
Yeah, that's another one of those big things that people like to talk about. In many countries in the world, including Malaysia, we have a newborn screening for example, you heard about G6PD, and we also have a screening for a condition called hypothyroidism, low thyroid hormone. Unfortunately, we have not really kept up with times, because in the public sector and in many of the countries around the world, including our ASEAN neighbours, for example, they have this thing called extended or expanded newborn screening, where a newborn who is 2 or 3 days old will have a heel prick, and a couple of drops of blood will be collected onto a piece of filter paper. And just from that drop of blood, they have this new technology called tandem mass spec, whereby they can actually analyze for 50 to 100 to thousands of diseases in one go. And these are diseases that will prevent mental or what you call learning disability in the child. And that's why it's always cost effective to have this expanded newborn screening program. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, we have not moved into this heel prick test because of logistic issue. We have been having many discussions with the Ministry of Health to advocate and to persuade them to launch this expanded newborn screening program, so that all the babies born in rural areas are getting the same treatment as those in the urban and the rich, delivered in the private hospitals or in keeping with the rest of the ASEAN region. But there are many logistic issues that need to be ironed out, because, for example, recalling of patients back for further testing and various other issues relating to logistic and cost.
So what about drugs which you identify which are available abroad but not approved in Malaysia? How can you bring it back for your child?
Yeah, good question. We have been having many discussions with the Ministry of Health and the Pharmaceutical Division. They are very receptive, I must say that. I'd like to thank them. They have expedited the process. If you have a drug that is not registered in the Ministry of Health, for example, you can submit your request, your application. And very often, you can even get it within a week. I have done that before. But generally, it takes like maybe a few weeks. So it's not like in months or years. It can be done. You take away the import permit, for example, for certain drugs for use on a compassionate basis. So I think in that sense, I think they really had done a lot to help patients.
And then you need to have the money to bring it in?
That's a separate issue.
You know, in line with that thinking about the money, you have there in front of you the National Policy on Rare Disease, Living with the with Dignity. And it says here specifically, in search of solution for rare diseases. Knowing you for so long, being the optimist that you are, 10 years down the line, rather than saying in search of solutions, right? Okay. Presumably, legislation changes and more government funding. Of course, that goes without saying. What else can be the solution for the these you know, unheard voices?
Yeah, basically, you just need to get everyone together. So when you talk about getting everyone together, get all the stakeholders, from ranging from the doctors to the parents to the patient groups. But we also need to work with government agencies, so Ministry of Health, Ministry of Women Community, and so on, because it's not just about drugs and surgery. It's also about education, job prospects for these individuals with rare conditions. Very often, they are ostracized, even discriminated because of their disability. So very often, they do not get jobs that they deserve. So they can't support themselves. So they are always in need of help. We do not want that, because they can be independent. They can just be like any one of us. And they are capable of going to study and go and graduate from universities. Many of our patients graduated, but sadly, they can't find good jobs.
You know, Dr. Tong, you come in contact with a lot of patients and parents. What would you like to leave us with this World Rare Disease Day?
I think we got to work together. We got to be inclusive. I think people should stop dividing each other out into smaller and smaller groups. I think all of us should come together unite, speak with one voice, because everybody deserves a second chance. So don't give up.
Well, that's a message on two fronts, World Rare Disease Day, and to all of us.
Yes, I know.
Your message, George.
Actually, you know, last time when we interviewed Edmund, obviously the thing that came out was the obstacle of diagnosis, the unity, the voice about diagnosis and treatment. But today, it's beyond that. And you highlighted that it's not just for that diagnosis and the child. So it's beyond that. And, you know, thank you very much for highlighting that. And also, we promised to brush up on poetry.
Poetry?
Early on, you know, when we pretend to understand, or I pretended to understand that poetry.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
I always knew you, George. Thank you very much, Dr. Tong, for joining us. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. Tong Myo Kyung, consultant pediatrician and clinical geneticist, this World Rare Disease Day on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.